Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna. Hej och välkommen till Hästveterinärerna. Det här är podcasten för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och arbetar med häst. Jag heter Maria Willemsson och i de kommande avsnitten ska vi prata om endokrina sjukdomar hos häst. Detta är ett ständigt aktuellt ämne och vi lär oss hela tiden mer i och med att forskningen går framåt. För att hjälpa oss att reda ut begreppen så kontaktade vi Sanna Lindåse. Hon är veterinär och forskare vid Sveriges lantbruksuniversitet. Sannas forskningsområde inkluderar behandling och management av hästar med endokrina metabola sjukdomar. Och hon är bland annat en av forskarna bakom den uppmärksammade studien om läkemedelsbehandling av EMS. I det här första avsnittet red Sanna ut terminologin och berättar om prevalens och diagnostik av insulindysreglering och EMS.
Today I have the pleasure to be joined by Sanna Lindåse, who is a veterinarian and works at the University of Agricultural Studies in Uppsala. Welcome to the podcast, Sanna.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your research and so on?
Of course. I will keep this quite short, but I'm a true horse person. I've been into horses my entire life. One of these horse-loving persons that has spent my entire childhood and youth in the stable. And I always have wanted to become a veterinarian since I was 4 years old, I think. So that I ended up at vet school and have horses as a topic for my clinical work and also my research is not a big surprise. So I graduated from the vet school in 2012 and I started my PhD studies just later, the same year, actually. And to go into research was, however, not at all according to my plan. But during my degree project, it actually struck me how extremely exciting and fun it is doing research. So I was hooked and I decided to take the chance when I was offered a position as a PhD student at the Division for Equine Internal Medicine here at SLU Uppsala. So I guess that decision many years ago is the reason for me being invited to this pod to talk about endocrine disorders in horses. And after my thesis defense in 2017, if I remember correctly, I have continued to work in the field of equine endocrinology. And my specific focus is equine metabolic syndrome and insulin dysregulation. And I'm now employed as a university lecturer, so I teach veterinary students in equine internal medicine, and I also have part-time as a postdoctor. So that is basically shortly my background and what I am working with today, and I think we will get the possibility to go deeper into the research later during this discussion.
Yes. So you have a solid background in the endocrinology sector, but you're also working a little bit clinically, or you have been at least, at the university hospital.
Yes, definitely. I do it quite a lot now. I'm currently have a little bit less research and have a bit more teaching and clinical work. So I'm at the clinic quite often recently and teaching students in internal medicine, not only endocrinology, in fact. Mm. Yeah. It's very interesting and very, very stimulating to have different parts. So my days don't look exactly the same, to say the least. It's a widespread of different tasks. So that is very, very fun, actually. Yeah. Mm.
Have you always been interested in the EMS and insulin dysregulation already at vet school? Or was this something that came with a PhD? Or how did that interest come up?
Yeah, a good question. Actually, when I was a vet student, we almost learned nothing about equine metabolic syndrome. I think it was like one or two slides during a lecture, basically. So remember that this is like over 10 years ago that I ended my vet school. So it actually came up during my degree project during year six, because I actually were offered to do my degree project into this subject. So that was when it all started, actually. And then I got stuck, and I'm so interested in internal medicine. So this is like a very tricky disease to work with. So it is quite rewarding when you are able to like solve different puzzles and solve questions in this very complicated disease. So yeah, I think that's why I got stuck, actually.
It's definitely a very interesting topic. And we're going to start talking a little bit about insulin dysregulation in this first episode. But to begin, we're talking about insulin dysregulation. We're talking about EMS, equine metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and so on. You know, I can't even say it myself. There are many terms and many abbreviations. Would you mind just explaining a little bit short, what are they exactly and what are the differences between them?
Yeah, that's a very good start, because it's a lot of confusions using these different terms. And I will keep it short, because I could probably talk about this in 20 minutes. So if we start with equine metabolic syndrome, that is like the main disease that have different comorbidities. And one of these comorbidities is abnormal insulin metabolism. Mm. And here we have all these different terms that are related to the insulin metabolism. So from the human perspective, it's like when we started working with this disease, we took a lot of knowledge from humans. And so in the beginning, we only talked about insulin resistance.
Yeah.
So insulin resistance referred to a state where we have decreased sensitivity for insulin in the peripheral tissue. So we talk muscles and we talk fat tissue mainly. So if this tissue doesn't respond normally when insulin is secreted, the beta cells in the pancreas need to increase the secretion of insulin. And this will cause a state where we have elevated insulin concentrations in plasma or blood. So elevated insulin is hyperinsulinemia.
Yeah.
So there we have two of the terms. And then a couple of years ago, a new term was proposed for horses with EMS that have these specific traits of symptoms. So the word or the term insulin dysregulation is like a unspecific term that include both insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia. And the hyperinsulinemia can be manifested during fasting conditions, and also, and maybe more importantly, during the time after feeding. So, and that we refer to as postprandial. So after a meal intake, you are in a postprandial phase. So it's not easy to understand even after I have tried to explain this, but the most important terms that I will come back to is hyperinsulinemia and insulin dysregulation. So you can remember that insulin dysregulation include both insulin resistance as well as hyperinsulinemia at fasting and postprandial state. That is mainly the most important thing.
Mm.
But we can relate to that right away, because why do we even care about this? Why do we even care about insulin dysregulation in horses?
Good question, yes.
Yeah, because, you know, if we compare horses to humans, these horses very, very seldom develop type 2 diabetes mellitus, which is the like end stage when it comes to insulin resistance in humans.
Yeah.
And then we can just start with, why is this a problem? And that is, of course, because the connection to and the link to laminitis in horses. And from experimental studies performed in horses, researchers have been able to induce laminitis in previously clinically healthy and non-laminitic patients. And this has been induced by a continuous rate of infusion of insulin.
Mm.
Like very high concentrations of insulin. So severe hyperinsulinemia are able to induce laminitis in previously healthy horses. So we know that there is a link between hyperinsulinemia and laminitis, but what happens in between, that is not my topic and we don't know. So I will stay away from the hoof and concentrate on the endocrine disorders. But so the ID is important from one perspective, more or less, and it is the connection to laminitis in horses.
Yeah. And that's also, yeah. I mean, the most severe symptom or is the most severe outcome from this disease as
yes.
well.
Yeah, definitely.
But thank you for clarifying that, because I think when you read about it and you come across all these terms, it's easy to think that this is probably something I should know. But if there are so many different ones, so it's good to have a sort of short explanation.
Yeah, I hope I did clarify it, not confuse even more. But we'll hope so.
It's clear to me anyway. Yeah. But I was then a little bit curious, because you started by mentioning EMS, and that is, of course, the syndrome, the whole spectra with many, as you said, comorbidities. But EMS is then defined as insulin dysregulation and obesity.
Yes, we have the other clinical characteristics. So we have obesity or regional adiposity, and included in EMS, we also often refer to a breed predisposition.
Yeah.
So we know that many breeds are predisposed, so some kind of genetic factor is definitely prevalent here. And we know that pony breeds and for our Scandinavian countries, at least in Sweden, Icelandic horses are very much overrepresented with this disease. And I know pony breeds like Connemara ponies and other UK native pony breeds are many times overrepresented also. So the genetics is not like, it's very difficult. Some studies have been performed, so there are not like... We don't know how the genetics works, but we know that they play an important role here.
Yeah.
And also, laminitis is actually also a part of this EMS disease complex due to the connection to hyperinsulinemia.
Yeah. But is it required for a horse to have had laminitis to get a diagnosis or to be an EMS horse? Or is it just
no.
that you think it's going to happen or it's more likely?
Yeah, I would say that I really hope that we diagnose the horse before it develops laminitis. And I think that the disturbed insulin dysregulation is more the way to diagnose EMS. So if we have insulin dysregulation, and we will come back to this when we talk about PPID, we see insulin dysregulation also in PPID horses. But insulin dysregulation without PPID, I would say that is how we identify horses with EMS. And then we have these clinical characteristics, but they can be there but they don't have to be. We learn more and more that horses with EMS can be in perfect body shape. Mm. They do not have to be overweight. They don't have to be obese. They do not have to have regional adiposity and so forth. So you cannot look at the horse and give the diagnosis EMS.
Mm. Yeah, that's very important, I think. The testing is a very important part of the diagnostics in this case.
Yeah, we will come back to that. But just one more comment about laminitis. So, of course, laminitis can develop due to many different systemic diseases in horses and also other things, of course. But we know that endocrine disorders are the main reason for horses developing laminitis.
Yeah.
So it is so important to work with these diseases if we are aiming at decreasing the degree of laminitis in the equine population.
Yeah. So when we're talking about these EMS horses, do you have any idea, or do we actually know anything about how common this is? How the prevalence is?
Yeah. Unfortunately, there are very, very little epidemiological data relating to the prevalence of EMS worldwide, I would say. Here in Scandinavia, we have nothing. There are a few studies, and actually one quite newly published, that have investigated the prevalence in UK native ponies in UK, which identified actually a prevalence of, I think it was slightly above 20%. Mm. But remember here that this is in this specific cohort of horses. And there are also some other studies performed in Australia and I think US that have found quite high prevalences in some cohorts of ponies and horses, I think between 20 and 30%. Mm. But it's so difficult to rely on these questions when we come, these numbers, when we come to the whole horse population.
Yeah.
Because as we know that we have a clear predisposition, I think we can't say that this prevalence is nearly close to what we see if we look at the whole horse population.
Mm.
So it's impossible to extrapolate this to all horses.
Yeah.
So we don't know is the short answer here. Yeah. but I think actually, even if we don't know the prevalence, I think that there is no like clinical working veterinarian that have not met a horse with EMS or laminitis.
Yeah.
So it is actually it's common. It's common, but how common it is, I don't know actually.
Yeah. And also when it comes to laminitis, then we're not going to stick that much to laminitis, but still it has been, and also in which we will be talking about later, the PPID cases, it has been an important sort of symptom that when you have a laminitic episode, that's when you take the tests and will diagnose either of the endocrine disorders. But the last, say, 10 years at least, this is something that have sort of come more to the mind of people and it's been talked about more and horse owners are more aware. Do you think that this means that we're able to diagnose more horses before they develop laminitis now compared to like 10 years ago? Or
yeah, that's very interesting. And I would really much wanted to have an answer on that. But, you know, if we don't have the prevalence, it's also very, very difficult to answer that. But it's a very interesting discussion because as you just mentioned, the knowledge and the awareness of these diseases has increased dramatically. Mm. As I told you in the beginning, I didn't even learn about these diseases more or less when I was a vet student for, a bit more than 10 years. Mm. But the information and the knowledge has like exploded during the last decade.
Mm.
And animal owners are much, much more informed and they are they know a lot about these diseases. So of course, I would have hoped that we maybe by increasing the awareness and learning horse owners how to manage the horses and so forth, that we are able to decrease the amount of horses that develop laminitis. But I still feel that we very, very often have these horses struggling with laminitis, this chronic laminitis cases that come back and they come back and they never get better, you know.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think it's this hard. And also, it's a very tough disease to work with because we don't have so much that we can do besides management. Maybe we will come back to that later. But I know that even perfectly managed horses, even if the owner does everything correct, they can still be very, very insulin dysregulated and have very severe laminitis.
Yeah.
And actually, I think we should not stick to laminitis. But as I said earlier, we know that ID is the most important reasons for laminitis.
Yeah.
And it's a very old study, but it's also very few horses. But I think it was performed. Yeah, it was in Finland. I think it was like in the early, maybe 2010, 11 or something, where they actually showed that I think it was 89% of laminitic cases that was admitted to a first opinion equine hospital were actually diagnosed with endocrinopathic laminitis.
Mm.
And I think more or less all horses were insulin dysregulated.
Mm.
One third or so were also had PPID. But so, I mean, if we would like to work and like decrease the suffering from horses that have laminitis, we need to solve the question insulin dysregulation.
Yeah.
So
moving on then to diagnostics. there are several different ways. What is the golden standard when it comes to diagnosing insulin resistance or insulin dysregulation? Sorry. And we're talking now here in the Scandinavian countries. I know that there are different ways of doing it and maybe different golden standards even when you ask people around the world. But here, what do we do here and what's the golden standard in your opinion?
Yeah, that is, we could talk about this forever also, because if we talk about gold standard for insulin sensitivity, like tissue insulin sensitivity, we have like very, very time-consuming, expensive tests that measure the degree of tissue insulin sensitivity.
Yeah.
We use them in a research perspective, but they do not fit at all in a clinical setting because they are too expensive and too difficult to perform. So when it comes to methods that are applied for clinical use, there are several different dynamic tests. But if we talk about the situation here in Scandinavia, I think it was like a game changer 10 years ago when a group in US developed this Carolite corn syrup, OST, because before this, the only method I think that clinicians were using were like taking fasting blood samples for insulin.
Yeah.
So this oral sugar test you use you can use it in the field. It works perfectly. And you administer some kind of syrup orally. The horse owner can do it themselves. And then you take blood samples in the postprandial phase. And as this Carolite is not available on the market in many parts of Europe and not in Scandinavia. So during my PhD, we did use this oral sugar test as a model, but we developed a new one using Dansukker glucose syrup instead. So we have a test that it is very similar. You use another sugar syrup, but everything works like in the same way, more or less, as for the Carolite corn syrup test. And this is a very convenient test. I would not call it a gold standard to measure ID. There is no gold standard to measure insulin dysregulation or ID, as there is for measurements of insulin sensitivity, which I just recently touched upon. But I think that we need to stay in focus of what is clinically applicable and what methods can we use in the clinics.
Yeah.
So I think we are stuck to the dynamic tests where we administer sugar syrup or something else orally. But even for a clinician, it's actually important to know that we're not truly measuring the same things if we use intravenous tests or if we use oral tests. Because when we administer something orally, like sugar, we will include factors that derive from the gastrointestinal tract. For once, we have like glucose, the intestinal glucose uptake, we have glucose trapping by the liver, and also the one important thing that we need to learn more about in horses is the incretin hormones that are secreted from the gut in response to a feed intake. And these incretin hormones work by increasing the insulin secretion from the beta cells to like make the body ready to take care of all these sugars that comes after a feed. So you at least have to know a bit about what you are testing. So we include these factors, but the positive thing, I think, with the dynamic oral test is that they are very similar to a feeding situation.
Yeah.
And that is actually what is important for the horse, because that is what the horse is like. It meets this every day. It will eat the same feed like several times every day. So if the horse has a very prominent insulin secretion in response to the feeding, they will probably have it also to the oral sugar test, because it mimics the feeding situation.
Yeah. Makes sense.
But the test is standardized instead of like feeding the horse. So we can have cutoffs that are applicable for like ruling in or ruling out the disease.
Yeah.
If we compare to just feeding the horse, we don't know what we should expect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But we're going to talk about that also later if there's a situation where you could actually feed a horse and then do this dynamic testing to get even more real-like results, you know, or reality-like results. Just shortly wanted to ask you about basal insulin, because I know that there are practitioners that use only basal insulin as their diagnostics. Is this a good idea or not, and why or yeah. why not. What's your thought about that?
Yeah, I guess this is also a difficult answer because, sorry, this is a difficult question I was about to say. But first again, you said basal insulin. So here we also have these different terms being used. So what is basal insulin and what is fasting insulin?
Yeah.
And I think that we are more prone to use fasting insulin. That means that you take a blood sample before the horse are eating, like in the morning before you feed the horse the breakfast. Basal insulin is more commonly used in other countries, and that is a situation when you take a blood sample at any time, so you do not know if the horse have been eating or not, or how much and so forth. So for me, it's much more difficult to interpret a basal insulin, if you mean basal insulin in the form that you take it whenever during the day, because you do not know what to expect, more or less. When it comes to fasting insulin concentrations, as I said earlier, that was used a lot before we started using this dynamic oral sugar tests. And I think it will have been ups and downs during the past decade. During many years, we said like, oh, fasting insulin, that is such a bad method. It's not worth anything to take a fasting blood sample. And then some new results were published, and we realized that maybe if you lower the cutoff for where you call the horse insulin dysregulated or not, you actually increase the sensitivity. That is not, that is like the way you do it when it comes to diagnostic test. If you lower the cutoff, the sensitivity for the disease will increase. But we actually found out that it's not so bad. But if you look at the individual horse, we performed one study and we actually saw that the fasting insulin concentration did not, for the individual horse, it was not perfect to explore the postprandial glucose increase, or sorry, the insulin increase, the postprandial insulin secretion in the individual horse. But if you're talking like big epidemiological data and epidemiological studies, this is a better idea because we can sample so many horses. So it depends on what you want to use it for.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that it's worthless, but we use it very seldomly, like the only diagnostic method. Or I do never, because I work in another environment. But I would say to the clinicians that it is not more difficult to perform a OST than to just take fasting blood samples. Because if you skip the first blood sampling, the fasting insulin concentration, then the horse owner can administer the glucose syrup, and then you can show up after 60 to 90 minutes and take the blood sample and then go away.
Yeah.
So it is not a big difference. I think it's what you are used to. I think it's many colleagues internationally and maybe also nationally that still are very negative to fasting insulin. And it is not my best friend either, but I don't think we should be so negative that we have been previously.
Yeah.
But we need to be careful when we interpret the results so that we look at lower cutoffs than what we normally have been doing.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Sanna, for this episode. We're going to keep talking about insulin dysregulation and a little bit more about treatment and also about PPID and, of course, the management in the coming episodes. Thank you very much. Tack för att du lyssnar på Hästveterinärerna. Om du gillar det du hör, glöm inte att trycka prenumerera i din podcastapp så att du inte missar några avsnitt. Berätta också gärna om vad du tycker genom att ge en recension. Vi tar gärna emot tips på kommande gäster och ämnen, och våra kontaktuppgifter finns i poddens beskrivning.